supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, many of you in the North are going to wake up one morning in March and find out the rosemary out in your garden is dead. There's nothing you can do about it then, but there is stuff you can do about it now, especially now. Will reveal the surprising secret to keeping rosemary alive over winter in a cold climb after lots of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kelly, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, how are you doing?
I am excellent today. Kelly, thank you for asking. How are you, sir?
I'm okay.
And where is Kelly okay?
I'm in Philadelphia.
Then you have to give us a neighborhood, Kel.
I live in Bella Vista near the Italian Market.
Oh, I know the area well. The far northern corner of South Philadelphia.
Yes.
All right. What can we do for Kelly in Bella Vista?
I have a Christmas cactus that has turned into a Thanksgiving cactus. It always seems to bloom early. It's been blooming for the last week and a half or so. It's finally doing really well in the pot that I have it in, which is a clay pot. And I have it in a sunny location. And I'm wondering if there's a way, if there's anything I can do to time the bloom so that it's delayed and comes at Christmas as opposed to Thanksgiving, and how best I might prolong the blooms once they start to appear. So right now they're starting to sag a little bit. Once it starts blooming, some of the little buds don't come to a full bloom. They just kind of peter out.
Okay, so what we learned years ago is the term Christmas cactus is generic. There are actually three or four different cacti that fall under this holiday kind of nomenclature. The Christmas cactus, the most common type, does bloom naturally closest to Christmas, although you realize it's going to be affected by a wide range of factors, daylight, watering, things like that. There actually is a plant called the Thanksgiving cactus that is genetically triggered to bloom a month or two earlier than the Christmas cactus. There's also one called the Easter cactus that blooms in the spring. And I forget exactly which one, but either the Thanksgiving or the Easter can bloom repeatedly throughout the season. So the basic answer is once the flower buds start forming, you want to give it good light but cool temperatures. Once flowers appear, cool temperatures prolong them, whereby hot temperatures, and especially hot and dry, will shorten the length of their life. Now, if you go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org, go to Garden Answers A to Z, and go to C for Christmas cactus, we have a little primer there on how to work the timing, wiggle the timing of these plants a little bit. There's also really specific descriptions of what the plants look like so that you can identify for sure which type of holiday cactus that you have. Now, how much light does this thing get?
Well, it gets a good deal of afternoon light. I put it in the sunniest side of the house, so it's getting, I guess that is a western exposure, so it's getting light during the second half of the day, and that's the sunniest location, but it's also probably one of the warmest because it's on the stairs leading up to the top floor of the townhouse. So,
oh, sure, that's where the heat rises to.
Yeah.
Okay. I would put a thermometer up there. If that's getting like above 70 degrees, I would try to do something to keep it a little bit cooler, especially when it's flowering. But the bottom line is all these cactus will go dormant at various times. When you see them coming into bloom, when they start to bud up, That's a time, believe it or not, you can actually have a pretty heavy hand with the water. That's when you don't want the plant to dry out. And okay. especially if you're up at the top of a heat sink, I would actually be misting this plant to help keep it hydrated. And in the article on the cactus, it'll give you some tips, again, on how to wiggle the timing by putting a box over the plant, giving it periods of darkness, cooling it down. Most of the time, you can get these plants to bloom when you want. But, it, you know, you have to pay a lot of attention. You got to cover them every night. You got to be really compulsive about the hours of daylight and darkness they get. My advice to a lot of people is, hey, if it blooms for a nice long period and it does good and it stays alive, that's great. Go out and buy an amaryllis at Christmas time.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll do that.
All right. Good luck, Kelly.
Thanks, sir. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hi, Mike. How you doing?
I am doing very well today, John. How are you, sir?
Good. I'm currently in Beaver Creek, Ohio. I live in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
What can we do for John in beautiful Yellow Springs?
Well, actually, I called you. You were talking to a woman about pyracantha. And you know, I've got that in my garden, and I like it. But I did have a mishap with it once where I got harpooned on one of the thorns. And my God, I thought, well, pyracantha, I think, means fire thorn, you know? And I think there's probably a reason. There's probably some kind of alkaloid or something. Do you know anything about that? Because, I mean, it was way more intense than just getting poked. It felt like a huge hornet sting.
Yeah, we got a lot of phone calls. We got a lot of reaction to that call where a woman was moving down to the Carolinas and wanted a vine that was going to have a lot of musculature over the winter, big berries to attract birds. And I remembered the pyracantha vines I see in Center City, Philly, that have been attached to the sides of buildings. I mean, it's tremendously dramatic plants. But mostly these are plants I see as I'm driving around the city. And even though I must have said on this show 100 times the common name is firethorn, it never occurred to me why. So you know that it's thorny. And, you know, fire I had always assumed was for the color of the berries, which are this kind of fiery orangey red. But it is not impossible that these are not just thorns, that the thorns give you a little something to take home with you. And I think that's also a reason, John, that people are growing it up against the sides of buildings and stuff, you know, so that they don't have to encounter the thorns. I will tell you one really unusual thing about pyracantha is that it has what are called extra floral nectaries. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. So
for honeybee or for ants or something?
Yes. So does forsythia and so do peonies. These are plants that pump out extra sugar in the spring, theoretically to attract pollinating insects. But as you know, especially with peonies, ants just love to come for the extra sugar.
Sure.
But with firethorn especially and forsythia, they also attract a beneficial insect called, I believe, the spring tiptia wasp or something like that. And this is a wasp that preys on Japanese beetles.
We need more of those, boy.
Like a lot of insects in the wasp and bee family, it does not look like what you would expect. Most of the descriptions say it looks like a large flying carpenter ant. But it's actually a wasp, and my understanding is it's one of these really cruel wasps that goes into the ground and lays its eggs inside of a Japanese beetle larva, a grub in the soil, before they can hatch. And then what happens is little baby wasps come out instead of Japanese beetles. So these plants are very useful in the garden. I'll tell you, I have some old climbing roses that have some nasty thorns on them. And every once in a while, I'll get stung, so to speak. And it will seem to affect me more than some other times. And what I think is going on is there's just a little allergic reaction there. And it might have something to do with the season. If you get impaled by a thorn in the spring, there's going to be a lot of sap in that thorn. So I'll do some research to see if there's any actual chemical. But, you know, thorns are there to defend the plant against herbivores. And thorns with some sort of toxin in them, they'd be really useful. But again, I think this is why we see it being trellised up the side of a house or a building or something like that. So it's not in the middle of a garden where you're playing Sleeping Beauty's Castle all the time.
That was my mistake then, because mine is definitely in the middle of one of my garden beds.
And, of course, now it's covered with thorns, so you can't move it. So good luck, John.
Yeah. It's fine. I just know to be careful around it.
Yeah. Enjoy the flowers. Enjoy the berries. Enjoy that extra sugar in the spring. It brings lots of beneficial insects to your garden.
Well, I'll keep an eye out for those parasitic wasps that look like carpenter bees. They're welcome in my garden.
All right. Good luck, John.
Thanks, Mike. Take care.
Thank you. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that while the rosemary we're going to discuss is somewhat frost-hardy, poinsettias are totally tropical, and Norfolk pines are from Australia and not any part of Virginia. But don't go apologizing to your dead outdoor holiday plants just yet, because we'll be right back with how to keep that rosemary alive and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, people down south and out west, they grow rosemary the size of trees. It just loves their mild winters. People up in the north, it does not love our mild winters and almost never survives north of an area, say, from Washington, D.C., unless you play some tricks on the plant, tricks we will describe in depth after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jennifer, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Jennifer, how are you today?
I'm fantastic.
And where is Jennifer fantastic?
I am in Germantown, Philadelphia.
Okay, the Germantown section of Philadelphia, one of the oldest and finest neighborhoods.
It's a wonderful neighborhood, and Lots of trees and gardens up in this area, too.
What can we do for Jennifer in Germantown?
I recently, about 2 weeks ago, planted a baby white fringe tree that I received from Tree Philly. It's a program that the city runs. They will give you a free tree every fall.
Oh, that's
plant in your yard. I did get a nectarine tree from them last year. I have a small, for Germantown, small yard.
Right.
And I planted my nectarine tree in the backyard. And I wanted to get another small tree. They do have large deciduous trees also. But I wanted another small tree for the front yard. So I picked the fringe tree, which stays small and shrub-like.
So you picked a great Native American tree that's underutilized, but a fabulous ornamental that all the experts are saying needs to be planted more.
Yes, I was excited that it was native and also that the flowers in the spring and summertime are very fragrant and attract pollinators.
Yeah, and again, the word fringe is not in there by accident. This thing is really striking. You're going to get a lot of comments on it.
Good, good. Yeah, I don't recall seeing any in this area, so it'll be a unique local tree.
Yeah, arborists wonder why there aren't more of them, because they are so nice. So what are your concerns, Jennifer?
Recently, you had a gentleman on the show talking about the emerald ash borer, which they believe is now attacking the white fringe tree. I found this out a couple days, maybe the day after I got my tree.
Of course you did.
It was on your episode.
Yeah. Nice of us to give you that little something to take home with you, right? You know.
Yeah, I had a very vocal oh no when I heard it on your show.
Yes, it turns out that the fringe tree is related to the ash tree, as is the lilac. It's a big, wide-ranging family. And we're seeing evidence that this emerald ash borer, this imported insect, is crossing over to some of these other plants. But one of the reassuring things this guy said was the habit of the tree, the fringe tree, is going to help protect it, where ash is just a single trunk tree. You've already seen yours is more like a shrub with multiple trunks, right?
It is. It's only about 3 feet tall at the most, but it has two distinct trunks coming out of it already.
Right. So here's the couple of things you can do, and you're wise to be ahead of the game. There is a brand new form of BT. BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, but that's just a family of these natural soil-dwelling organisms. The old original BT has been around for 50 years. It only works against caterpillars. There's one called BTI that's in those mosquito dunks you use to prevent mosquito breeding in standing water. And just this season, just this year introduced, is BTG, standing for Galleria. And as we go to press, so to speak, if we had presses, the only place you can get it is from Gardens Alive. They're the exclusive distributor of it.
Okay.
But you can get it from them, and they market it mostly against Japanese beetles because that's one of the most common infuriating pests in America. But it's active against a wide range of plant-eating beetles. So spraying it on your fringe tree over the season will protect it from the emerald ash borer. It's actually EPA registered against the emerald ash borer, but it's not a toxic pesticide. It won't harm the bees that come to pollinate the flowers. It won't harm birds. It will only harm insects of the beetle family that try to feed on the bark or the leaves or any other part of the tree. One thing we also learned about the emerald ash borer is they start by feeding on the leaves. So if you spray the leaves regularly with this BTG, you'll stop them before anything starts. And then all you got to do is once a week, you just want to inspect the various trunks of your fringe tree. More may come up out of the ground. And if you see any little holes in the trunk, get a paper clip and spread it open and jab around in that hole. You live in Philadelphia, so I don't have to tell you to taunt the creature that you're stabbing in there and call it names, and then spray a little BTG in there for good luck. But because the fringe tree is multi-trunked and multi-limbed, this guy feels that they can take a tremendous amount of pressure and still keep coming back. And so far, the fringe trees he's seen that have been attacked, they're doing just fine because they have more things going for them than an ash tree. And also, the small size of the tree means you can keep an eye on it. You can spray the leaves easily over the summertime. You can take good looks at all part of the trunk. So I would not be worried one bit.
Perfect.
All right.
Okay. That sounds great.
All right. Good luck, Jen.
Thank you, Mike.
1-888-346-9499. George, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, George. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine today.
And where is George doing fine?
I'm doing fine in Dudley, North Carolina.
And is that near the coastline?
That's about 80 miles from Wilmington and 60 miles from the capital, Raleigh.
Okay, very good. What can we do for George in North Carolina?
I've got some grapevines, and I want to know when was the best time to prune them.
Okay. Did you plant these grapevines?
No, they came up kind of volunteer grapevines, and I moved them from one place to the other, and they've been burned really good.
Oh, okay. That's very interesting. So when did you move them?
I moved them about 2 years ago. Ever since I moved them, they've been burning real good.
Okay, and I presume there's some sort of just fresh eating grape, like a Concord grape, something like that?
Yes, they're a Concord grape.
And you like them? You like the taste of them?
Yes, I really like them.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. And do you have them trellised or trained? Are you supporting the vines in any way?
Yes, I have a wire that run about 25 feet, and I haven't trained to run down that wire yet.
Okay, good, good. And you haven't had any disease problems? You haven't had any mildew or anything like that?
Oh, no, nothing like that. It's very healthy.
Excellent. Well, the best time to prune grapevines, I would say, in your region, your winters are very mild. But the grapevines are going to go dormant, and I would wait until kind of the last minute. I would wait until they started to grow again. And then there's all sorts of different attitudes about pruning. Most advocates are going to say to prune them back really hard. But you haven't pruned yours at all, and they're doing very well. So I want to be a little more cautious. I want you to cut away anything you don't like the look of.
Okay.
Anything that looks a little diseased or like it might have some rot. And then after that, what you're mostly going to be pruning for is airflow. You don't want the vines to get too crowded. You know, you don't want three or four arms on the same trellis because it'll just get too congested in there, and then you will see signs of disease. So when you're pruning, one of the best things to think about is think of yourself as the wind. And you're pruning so that you can get through, so that especially early in the morning, the breeze can get to all parts of your grapevine and really help dry things out. And now that your grapes are, let's say they're going to be 3 or 4 years old, I want you to seriously consider looking at the vines in the early summer and seeing if the greenery and the fruits are too crowded, because you know how lush these grapevines can get.
Yeah.
So if you see areas that are just clogged up, that just are nothing but a tangled mass of leaves, get in there and remove some of the leaves to improve the airflow.
What month would I do this?
I'm thinking like where you are, June. And don't be afraid to do it again in July. And then as long as your grape clusters are far enough apart, you can let them all go. But if there's an area on this trellis where you got 3 or 4 clusters all next to each other, early in the season when they're just babies, pull off 1 or 2 of those clusters. Because as your vine gets older, it'll start to get more crowded. And the older it gets, the more you have to take off to get high-quality fruit at the end. But also, the older it gets, the more it's just going to produce to begin with. So you want to make sure that there's, again, always for airflow, you're always preventing overcrowding. That's really the true need for pruning in this case, is to keep the plant open. And then as the season progresses, don't be afraid to just look at them every day and pull off a leaf or two if you see an area is really crowded. All right, George.
I really appreciate that. And thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, George. Enjoy your grapes.
I will.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Ken, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. I'm calling about my home in Hatboro. So we've got a large silver maple in our backyard. It's about 70 feet tall, about 4 feet above the ground. It divides into two trunks, and about 2.5 feet above the ground, there's a hole in which we found some carpenter ants. The tree itself is otherwise healthy and beautiful and brings lots of shade to the backyard, so we're trying to do all that we can to preserve it and also protect the house, since it's only about 20 feet away from our house. We're trying to figure out what we need to do as far as pruning, and I know you've very carefully given listeners instructions to not prune anything unless you're sure about when to prune. Also try to figure out what to do, if anything, with regards to the ants. And finally decide if there's anything to be gained by cabling or rotting the two sides of the trunk together as far as, again, helping to preserve the tree and our home.
Okay, so there's ants in this hole.
Correct, carpenter ants.
Now, does the hole look like it would have formed naturally because of the split in the tree? In other words, when the trunks diverged, did it create an area where water would have pooled up?
It's actually opposite side to where the trunks diverge, and it looks like a previous owner may have actually tried to fill the patch with concrete. So also it looks like over time the tree itself has tried to self-repair, because I can see it seems like the bark is growing in closer to the hole, but the hole seems to be pretty big.
You know, one thing you have to be aware of is these silver maples are very brittle trees. Tell me it hasn't dropped any branches down on the ground.
It does drop some, but, you know, there's not a lot of dead branches in the top part of the tree that I can see. So,
okay.
You know, the roots are pretty well spread.
Good.
And it seems, you know, but for the hole, you know, and the split.
No, don't look at the hole. The thing that tells you the health of the tree is how it leafs out every spring.
Okay, there are tons of leaves.
Okay. And you're not going to try to do this work yourself. You're going to hire an arborist.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You want a certified arborist. You want them to go up into the top of the tree anywhere from January, February, through when the leaves start coming on again. And you want them to clear out any dead wood. And also, while they're up there, they'll be able to see which branches look like they're going to become problematic in future years. Because this is expensive to have guys go up in the tree. So you want them to do a good job. As for the cabling, you want to read online reviews. You also want to see, I mean, I want these guys to be certified. There's a international organization of arborists that actually certifies real professional tree workers. And after they're done cleaning out the canopy, what they're going to do is actually measure the area between the two trunks, and they're going to measure the angles of the trunks. The more the trunks go straight up from the split, the less pressure there is on that central point. But if they're making a V, then there's a point, and it really can come down to a calculation where they're going to suggest cabling it. If you get a really reputable arborist and they're highly recommending cabling it, it's a good investment. Because the one thing I learned, oddly enough, from Sandy, is if a tree comes down near your house but doesn't hit your house, the insurance company will have nothing to do with you. You'll have to have the tree cut up and taken away and everything like that. But if it just touches the house, the insurance company will pay for everything. Of course, you might have been in that room in the house at the time, and you don't want that to happen. But this would be, cabling is your best insurance.
You get to be the judge, but I have actually spoken to two certified arborists, and they have divergent opinions on how to handle it. One says cable, and one suggests that even if you cable, it's not going to preserve the tree. One says, oh, now that all the leaves are fallen, the tree is considered dormant, and others are saying better to wait until January or February. So
right away, I'm with the January, February guys.
Okay.
Because right now, after the leaves drop, you're entering dormancy, but you're not there, and pruning can stimulate growth. That's the last thing you want to do on a tree like this. So I would go with the guys who are talking January, February.
Okay, cool. And as far as the ants and the holes?
It's a dodge. Don't worry about it. Yeah, don't do anything.
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right.
Have a great holiday.
You too. Good luck, Ken.
Take care. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone fretting about finding the perfect present that gifts of membership in the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society include tickets to the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show in March. But don't go looking for all the details at theflowershow.com just yet, because we'll be right back with surprisingly helpful advice about rosemary and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get to a very festive question of the week. How to keep rosemary alive over winter in the north? How to get it to grow into one of those big bushy shrubs that we envy when we're down south or out west? And how it all starts with the Christmas holidays. We'll tie all those things up together, put them in a box with a bow, and give you all the rosemary details after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am just ducky today, John. How are you, sir?
Also good, thanks. I'm calling from East Falls in Philadelphia here, and I had a question about my fish tank water.
East Falls, right off of the beautiful river, right there on the East River Drive on the Schuylkill.
Yeah, you got it.
All right. What can we do for John near one of the famed rivers of Pennsylvania?
Well, I got a small fish tank in my living room, and because my apartment's kind of small, it gets a little more sunlight than it probably should. So I get some algae in the water a little bit, and that means I have to siphon out the water once or twice a month, just to, you know, 10 or 20% of the water, just to keep it clear. But I also vacuum the gravel out when I do that, too, and that gets a lot of fish poop to come out of the water and keep it clean. And I started putting that into my house plants. I kind of thought it might be good fertilizer for them, or, you know, it might help them in some way. And I thought I'd give you a call and see what you had to say about that.
Well, the bottom line, the quick answer, is that fish waste itself is a tremendous fertilizer.
Oh, okay.
It's very beneficial. Now, there's a couple of things you want to be careful about. Do you treat the fish water with anything?
I do put I don't know what the chemical is. When I take it out of the sink, it's supposed to neutralize the chlorine in my tap water before I put it into the fish tank, but that's it.
Okay, well, no, that's good, because chlorine is not good for plants either.
Right.
And you've been doing this for how long?
Half a year, I guess, 6 months.
Okay, and you've seen very good results, I presume.
Good results, but definitely no negative results.
Yeah, and I guess my big question to you, is there any smell?
No, there's no smell. It doesn't stink. It smells like a fish tank, but it smells like a fish tank should, you know?
Okay, good, good. Well, and certainly you don't mind.
No.
Okay, so here is my only instruction or advice to you. The basic answer is this water is great for any plant anywhere. House plants, roses outside, tomatoes in a vegetable garden. It really does have tremendous nutrients that are hard to capture commercially. You know, we capture a lot of fish, but, you know, fish poop tends to pretty much stay in the ocean and in the rivers. So, but it's very beneficial for plants. My only, again, advice here is as we get deeper into winter, the rule is to back off any feeding of your plants. You don't want to overfeed them over winter. Do you have any plants that are aggressive growers over winter that should be fed, like indoor citrus?
No, nothing like that. I do have one plant that flowers most of the winter. I think you call it a crown of thorns.
Oh, okay. That is a good sign. Plants that are actively growing and that are flowering, absolutely keep feeding them. If possible, have a light hand with, like, regular house plants, like, you know, the snake plant, mother-in-law's tongue, and,
right. You
know, a ficus, you know. It's still okay. I mean, that's millions of times better than just straight city water. But try to have a light hand, and then the time to really feed house plants aggressively is in the spring.
Okay.
You know, because even though they're indoors, they know what's happening outside.
Well, it kind of works out because I only need to change the water maybe once a month, twice at most, and that's usually when the sun's shining in the spring and summer too, you know, so it, I guess that problem kind of takes care of itself.
Yeah, and you got a little ecosystem. You are, you're like, what do you call it? It's not hydro, aquaponics, where you have fish and plants coexisting in a closed circle ecosystem, John.
I didn't even think of that. It's a great point.
All right. Yeah, you're living the life. You're closing the circle, baby.
Love it.
All right. Well, good luck, John.
Thank you, Mike.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Tom. How are you, sir?
I'm fine here in Bristol, PA.
I lived in Bristol, PA.
Get out of here. I would have known about that if you lived in Bristol.
Do you know the castle on Red Cedar Drive?
Right, yeah, I know that.
That was the original American home of the Wistar Institute. And when my wife and I were first together as a couple, we rented one end of that castle from the guy who had rehabbed it. And it's a real replica of a German castle with 6-inch poured concrete walls all around it and turrets and guardhouse posts.
How long were you there?
We were there 5 years.
Wow.
So what can we do for Tom in my old neighborhood of Bristol?
I have a compost question.
Go ahead.
About maybe 25 years or so ago, I used to add fish waste and in the fall and dried horse manure.
Okay.
I used to take trenches and put all this fish waste in.
Okay.
I had that for a number of years because I knew this guy had a fish place. He was always cutting up fish in Trenton. I used to get the waste from there and bring it home. Now, I've been for the past 10 years just putting in mulch, leaves, and grass in the fall. And a neighbor here just told me he has an opportunity. He has this fruit and vegetable compost.
Okay.
Yards of it available. And if I wanted it to put it down in the fall. And I was wondering, is it good to put that down in the fall since it's composted like you normally do? Or can you also use that in the spring?
Well, have you seen this material, Tom?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
You say fruit and vegetable waste. That stuff is actually tough to compost on a commercial scale. There's three ways to do it. You can either mix it with huge amounts of carbon material, like wood chips, shredded fall leaves, or carbon-rich material like that. But most of the time, in an industrial process, food waste is composted either using specialized worms in a big building, or there's a way to do it with, like, bacteria and enzymes. And you say this is bulk compost?
Yes.
Is it at a recycling center? Is it municipal?
He does lawns, and he was doing my lawn and said that he had this available if I wanted to use it. He said it was, like, fine, almost like mulch leaves.
Okay. Well, what I would do is I would either go visit it or ask him to bring you a sample, like a 5-gallon bucket worth.
Right.
And then first you want to give it the duck test. How does it smell? Is there any off smell whatsoever? If there is, you don't want it. How does it look? Is it rich and black and fine particles? That's what you want. And then pick some up and squeeze it. You know, the classic line is it should feel like a wrung out sponge.
Okay.
So if it looks like good compost, feels like good compost, and smells like good compost, it should be good compost. But because you say this guy is into lawn care, you want to make sure that there were no grass clippings in there.
Oh, yeah?
Because grass clippings from lawns managed with commercial herbicides can create plant deadly compost. These herbicides are designed to kill any plant that's not a blade of grass. So if they get into the composting process, they can wreak havoc. Luckily, it's real easy to test. You just get a little pot, a little container of some kind. You fill it with some of the compost, and then you put some seeds in it, whatever you have around. The ideal seeds would be pea or beans, like, you know, English peas or snow peas or string beans, any kind of pea or bean seed. But if you have fresh seeds of, like, tomato or pepper or lettuce, anything like that, that's fine. Just plant the seeds, keep the thing well watered, give it good light, and if the sprouts come up and look normal, then the compost is safe to use throughout your garden. If nothing comes up, or if they come up looking all yellowed or distorted,
right,
don't be using that compost. So that's why it's really important to test a little amount before you have 3 yards of it sitting in your driveway and realize, oh my God, I can't get this anywhere near a plant.
Yeah, then I'm really stuck.
Although that compost is still safe for putting on lawns.
Oh, okay.
Because the herbicides used on lawns are designed not to kill lawns.
Fall is still a good time to put it down, right? I mean, the spring is also good when it
yes.
comes to compost it.
You know,
time.
What I tell people is if it's at their house and they need to clean out the old bins to start a new run of compost, they should put it on their garden beds. If you have a choice, I would get the samples now. I would test them over winter, but I would wait till spring to apply it to the garden.
Oh, okay.
All right, Tom?
All right, Mike. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure, man.
Take care. Bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Turning Christmas rosemary trees into full-time plants. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with this week's oh-so-festive question.
So, it looks like you went through some dusty email files and found an oldie but goodie that never made it to the show.
Hey, come on. A well-filed email gathers no dust. And this question is a great example of one we receive frequently. And this is pretty much the only time a year I have an answer that's relatively doable. So,
Dan in Sellersville, PA wrote, I try every year to grow rosemary. It does great, but does not return after winter. Is there a certain type of rosemary that would be more hardy over the winter, or should I pot it for the first year or two and then transplant it to my herb garden? We'd like to have a really tall and bushy rosemary.
Well, rosemary is a Mediterranean plant, like the fig trees that are such a hot topic on this show. Unfortunately, unlike figs, whose roots survive cold winters so often I'm tempted to call the plants herbaceous perennials, rosemary just plain dies if left outdoors over the winter in regions roughly north of Washington, D.C. It can't come back or return like a fig. And it doesn't matter how big or old the rosemary plant is.
Is there a certain type that is more cold hardy?
Well, there is the legendary variety ARP, A-R-P. Years ago, I tested it against a whole slew of other rosemaries, and it did last the longest, but that just meant it was the last one to die in my garden. Now, I'll add that many experts feel that rosemary might be able to survive my winter temperatures, especially if the plants are growing in a protected location, but not my high rainfall. Like its cousin lavender, rosemary can't stand waterlogged soil. And without summer heat to help dry them out, northern soils do stay pretty damp over most winters.
So it sounds like he's chasing the impossible dream.
Well, let's call it the difficult dream. But this is the time of year you can realistically jumpstart that dream with one of those little foot-high rosemary Christmas trees you see for sale at garden centers and upscale supermarkets. These are live plants with impressively large root systems. If they hadn't been aggressively pruned into those conical shapes, they'd already be a couple feet tall each. Even after they're pruned, they're still much bigger than any kind of plant you can buy in the spring.
But as you warn every holiday season, they won't make it to New Year's unless you get them into a bigger pot right away.
It really is just absolutely essential. The growers in California prune big shrubs down into those festive shapes and squeeze their giant root balls into the smallest possible pots. That's great for their ease of shipping, but it makes it almost impossible for a homeowner to keep the things well watered. So you got to take them out of their cute little pots, notice how little actual soil there is in there, and put them into containers that are at least twice as large and have great drainage holes in the bottom. Use the loosest, lightest bagged potting soil you can find to fill in the sides and bottom. Not dirt from your garden. It's just not going to drain well enough.
Okay, so they definitely have to find a special kind of soil, but any special kind of pot?
Ideally, the biggest one that you can move in and out of the house easily. And I'll add that Terry Ettinger, a garden writer who's based in Syracuse, strongly suggests it be made of real terracotta for this purpose, because it wicks its moisture into the air and stays naturally drier. Anyway, sit the newly potted plant in a few inches of water for an hour or more, and let those drainage holes in the bottom suck up enough to totally saturate the soil. Now, feel the weight of the well-watered pot. Let it drain in the dish rack, then put it on a plate to protect the surface it's going to sit on. place it in a spot that gets your absolute brightest light, but not near a radiator or forced hot air.
And don't water it again until the pot feels much lighter, which could happen in a few days or a few weeks, depending on your indoor humidity.
And when that time comes, repeat the sitting and water routine, saturating the soil from below and then letting the plant dry out completely before watering it again is your best bet for long-term survival.
And north of D.C., I would assume it stays inside all winter, right?
Not necessarily. I bought a, quote, rosemary tree 3 seasons ago that actually turned out to be 2 of the things jammed together into one pot. Now, one of the plants died that winter, but the other one survived. And I put it outside really early, in early March, because rosemary can take light frosts. It's really the combination of extended hard cold and waterlogged soil that gets them.
It survived 3 years? Is this tree still alive?
Yeah, and it's not shaped like a Christmas tree anymore. It's a big shrub that's around 3 feet tall. And it's still outside for this season as we speak. I'm only going to bring it inside during the worst stretches of extended cold.
And ice storms, of course.
Thanks for reminding us all of joys to come. And for giving our southern and western listeners a good laugh. They have rosemary plants the size of a small car. Well, that sure was some surprisingly useful information about keeping rosemary alive in the north now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to leave me outside in a nice storm if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched, questions teeming towards our garden shore with your location at garden@whyy.org. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares about your location and where you will probably find the answers to most of those questions you are going to ask, plus audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Lauren Elkins keep our website alive over winter. The perennial Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY FM in Philadelphia. Al Banks is our semi-hardy editor. Frost-free Stephen Dre Hobel is our ace production assistant. I'm already freezing Mike McGrath. And you know, I could have been a brain surgeon, but I wanted to be my own boss. So I guess I'll have to see you again next week. Is your lawn full of thatch? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the surprising cause and even more shocking cure for that unsightly layer of brown down low. Plus your fabulous phone calls.